Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 414 of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her fun. That's right, it's her fun time. Oh my gosh, I'm just loving every moment of this. So yeah, you do deserve to have fun. Now, come on now. Before we begin this fabulous episode, just know that the show is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins. That's S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. And you know what it's like, ladies. You try to eat all your little veggies and fruits and nothing happens. It's just the whole thing is a cluster all day long and you're just chasing your tail. So we got to fill in some gaps here. So the liposomal multivitamins will help fill in some of those nutritional gaps because we're just human beings. I know it's hard to accept. So run on over to solaray.com and learn more. Here's your first reminder to click on iTunes after the episode and rate and review the show because my team and I are just sitting around going like this, waiting to hear from you. We got little thumbs going round and round and round. All right, it's time for Her.
Her.
The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life.
It's all about Her.
Now introducing our wonderful guest, Dr. Mike Rucker. Mike, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Awesome. Well, this is all about a book. Oh, look, I got the book right here. Look at the little lucky person that I am. And the book is called The Fun Habit, How the Pursuit of Joy and Wonder Can Change Your Life. Yeah, it can. So don't argue with me, damn it. All right. So Mike is pretty amazing. I just love this. Off his Twitter feed is in no particular order: author, father, husband, organizational psychologist, behavioral scientist, recovering entrepreneur, fitness enthusiast, yay, with mechanical parts. All right. VW bus aficionado, and then seeker, traveler, future astronaut. Okay, that's my kind of guy. I'm just, you know, I'm going to say I've got like a whole thing for people who do things like this. So, Mike, tell us about your background. How did you get here to this point where you're writing this amazing book?
Yeah, so to back up a little bit, I got interested in positive psychology when a lot of the figureheads in that area had put together a consortium called the International Positive Psychology Association. You know, obviously people had been looking at it before then, but figureheads like Csikszentmihalyi, who some folks might be familiar with FLO, he's kind of the godfather of that. Another gentleman by the name of Marty Seligman that has some good books about happiness. They had come together with a bunch of other academics and created this sort of tribe, as it were. And I got early access. I was a charter member of that association and really drank from all the wisdom that came and it's still coming from that discipline. And for folks that don't know what positive psychology is, it's essentially a facet of psychology that's meant to be used for betterment. Before we had that word, psychology had really been thought of, you know, tools to treat poor mental hygiene and clinical conditions and things of that nature. And so I think what had happened from that period, like many people, I was aggressively pursuing happiness, right? And so now we have a term for that, toxic positivity, right? But back then, I think we were still wearing our good vibes only shirts and things of that nature. And long story short, a lot of those tools had been fairly successful, but I had essentially overprescribed on them and had a couple unfortunate events happen to me. My younger brother passed away quite suddenly from a pulmonary embolism. And then the mechanical parts thing that you mentioned, after being a lifelong runner, found out that I likely had an undiagnosed injury and had to get an early hip replacement, which essentially meant I couldn't run again. And so I had been pretty Pollyanna up to that point, and there were these big, heavy things I need to deal with, but I essentially thought I could, you know, will myself to being happy again. And the more that I chased happiness, paradoxically, I was becoming more unhappy. And now we know why, right? The work of Dr. Iris Mouse out of Cal and a bunch of others have found that not necessarily valuing happiness, because I think that's a great thing. We all want people to be happy. We all want them to flourish. But folks that have this overly concern about happiness, especially their own happiness, and ruminate in that, tend to sort of CBT in reverse, right? You start to ruminate in a way that makes you unhappy. And so my awakening was, well, okay, great. All these tools that had been so successful at kind of living the good life were essentially counterproductive. You know, what could I do from there? And what I found was that you can still go and seek out joy and delight no matter what your circumstance, even if at that point you're not, you know, in an emotional state to be quote unquote happy, the way we describe happiness in the West, right? And then I unpack some of the other challenges, right? When we start to quantify happiness on a scale of 0 to 10, what happens when you reach that 10, right? Like inherently, you know, if there's anything that sort of knocks you off that peak, you start to identify as being less happy than you want to be, which we know becomes quite problematic. And so the way that I define the construct of fun is really just anything that you're actually enjoying, and you do have the agency and autonomy to either architect things in a way that you find joyful or choose those activities based on having some time affluence, you know, some control domain over how you spend your time. And if you're mindful of that, you really can steer the ship in the right direction, and it becomes more invigorating, more renewable, rather than always chasing happiness.
I love this whole discussion as we're kind of getting into this, because people think certain things will make them happy. There's no question about it. Like, I'm going to get that MD. I'm going to get that PhD. I'm going to get that JD, and I will be happy. No. It opened up a bunch of doors, but oh no. Happiness is a very different kind of thing. If you want to see happy, look at a child's face. That's happy.
Right.
But children are also playing. And this is why I love in chapter 2, it said time to play. All right. So Wanda Sykes is the first quote you have. I'm here today because I refused to be unhappy. I took a chance. I love that. That's very cool. So now what you have is, I love this little diagram you have of a play model, pleasing, living, agonizing, yielding. And what is it like to play? And one of the things I remember is a colleague of mine wrote a book about the adult recess. We need a recess. We do. Drop all of the things that you're doing and run outdoors and throw a ball or something. You know, just have fun, play. And I think that so many adults have just forgotten what the heck that is. And why is play so important? And what role does it fulfill in this whole world of happiness?
Yeah, I think whether it's the construct of play, which is really, you know, an activity, or just finding fun in what you do, whatever that is, play or a hobby or a connection with loved ones or, you know, your pet or whatever it is, we know from this concept, the hedonic flexibility principle, is that when we're not enjoying what we're doing, whether that's work or, you know, the leisure time that we have, we end up being depleted. And so the problem there is that it's insidious. Like you said, if we're not taking time off for ourselves, whether we want to call that recess or transition ritual from work to time that's meant for us, whatever it is, if you're not taking control, agency over how you spend your time, you end up burning out. And the problem is it happens over time. We talk about either it being a downward spiral, an upward spiral, right? And if you continually are not really enjoying what you're doing, either at work or outside of work, you're going to get depleted. And we know that there's a whole host of physiological and psychological negative outcomes that come from that. The converse of that is that once you start enjoying yourself, you know, whether that's through leisurely play, whether that's through making sure that you're taking time to kind of escape work, whether that's reorganizing your work so it's actually enjoyable. It's a cliche, you know, enjoying the journey, not the destination. That's because the destination's fleeting, right? And so how can you organize time in a way where you're actually enjoying it? Because what we found is that people that are actually enjoying their time have the resilience to show up for the hard things with more vigor and vitality. And so that's one benefit. The second is, because your fun cup, quote unquote, is full, you also invite harder challenges. So that's also where growth lives, right? So it's a 1-2 punch in the sense that you're able to actually paradoxically be more productive when you're actually enjoying yourself, taking time for renewal, finding breaks within your schedule to actually enjoy yourself. And you seek out things that are harder, so you actually grow more. And that's what's been insidious here in the US, right? It's so many of us derive our self-worth from productivity that even outside of being productive, whether we call that admin work, whether we call that, you know, some people are calling it busy because busy work doesn't really lead, doesn't move the needle, but it makes you feel good because you displace that discomfort by kind of looking at your spam folder. Like, that's not really work, right? In fact, I was just talking to a physician this morning that called it pajama time, right? Because that's like EMRs have created such busy work for physicians that they're not getting paid for that, but they're having to communicate with patients because of the extra burden that EMRs puts on them. So depending on your vocation, that could be insidiously eating up your schedule, whatever that is. That means we need to be more mindful of creating those bumper rails so we can play, so we can have fun, so we can invite those things in that really light us up so we have the energy to do the harder stuff.
It's almost like you want to kind of change your perspective a little bit so it becomes more, as it were, play-centric. So if you actually look at the longevity studies, and I point to a boatload of them that have been published, we find that as people who have been very successful at becoming robust centenarians, they literally have built into the fabric of their life tons of playtime, which also brings me back to one of my most favorite quotes from George Bernard Shaw, which you know, and we don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing. That always echoes in the back of my head when I read these studies, when you see older people hanging out, having a good time. And there's no one like saying, oh, were you productive? Of course they're productive. They've been productive all their life, but they've also had this beautiful, and I use the word balance very carefully. I'm not talking 50-50 or any of this ridiculousness.
I like the word blend now.
Yeah, I love blend. I love that because then you can define what's blending for you. I'm going to define it for me because what it takes for me to feel joyful and happy may be either more or less than what it takes for you. And I'm good with that. Everyone's unique and that's the way it rolls. I completely avoid any of these weird algorithms out there because they're meaningless to me. We're just human beings and we're trying to figure it out as we go along. But the issue of play is so terribly important. Now, I define it all kinds of fun ways. I mean, I can play in my garden. I'll have sweat pouring down and, you know, I'll have thorns in my head and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But for me, it's play. I'm also an athlete. So for my idea of playing, it is probably torture for other people, but I love it, you know, and I could play with my kettlebell all day and I'm a triathlete, so I could do all that stuff. To me, it's like, hey, let's play. It's like me as a little girl saying to the kids in the neighborhood, let's hit our bicycles, you know? And I think people just need to respect the role of play in our whole construct of happiness. When's the last time you laughed to death? Just laugh and laugh and laugh and just, you felt like you were just vital. When's the last time that happened? You know, the old saying that, you know, a kid laughs on average about 300 times a day and a human adult is like 10.
Yeah, 17, I believe. The commonality I found there too is connection. Looking at the same longevity studies, it's clear that even if you're an introvert, it doesn't necessarily need to be connected with people, although it's clear that that's an important component. But if you're playing with a hobby, if you're playing with nature, as you mentioned, with gardening, whatever that connection is, makes us feel like we're a part of something bigger. And when we don't have that aspect of our lives, right, then we internalize all of our problems. And at an individual level, right, kind of the metaphor of if we make ourselves the center of the universe, then of course, our personal problems are humongous. But when you realize that you're part of a bigger system and that bigger system is friendly, you know, there's enjoyment there. To your point, there's laughter there. There's connection. It fills you up. What we call in psychology, positive valence. These things attract you to them and vice versa. then all of a sudden, some of your bigger problems aren't as big in that context because you are part of this bigger system. And so you can reflect on things that might have really been weighing heavy on you and realize that,